And finally, energy companies raking in record profits. I mean record profits. Let's take a look at Shell first. For the year 2021, $6.4 billion in profits. Figure for 2020, $393 million. Then we move on to BP. 2021, $12.82 billion in profits, while in the year 2020, they actually posted a loss of $5.7 billion. That's quite a profit. And that's drawn the anger of many in the UK that say, wait a minute, you guys should share some of this increase in our energy bills that's happening as a result. All right, let's try to break this down a little bit and see what our guest thinks about this. We are going to have our guest rejoin us for a breakdown. Herman Kelly is president of the Irish Freedom Party and former journalist who rejoins us from Dublin, Ireland. All right, Herman Kelly, welcome. So when you take a look at what has happened in the UK, it's quite incredible with the energy prices at 53%. And then, of course, we're looking at the inflation, taxes, et cetera. How can the UK see any relief from this, especially how this is affecting the middle class also?
Sadly, for the whole of Europe, it's just not the UK who are experiencing the increase in energy prices. That's kind of universal, as far as I can see, around the EU and certainly in Ireland. Inflation is at 5%, and energy prices have gone up a lot as well, even within the last year. But inflation is certainly starting to bite.
The rising cost has raised calls on EU leaders to help the continent develop more reliable energy sources and help the transition towards green energy. The UK is no longer an EU member, but in terms of the economy, it's not faring better either. In December 2021, Britain's inflation soared to a 30-year high, and the upward trend has since continued. The inflation rate is expected to increase further in the coming months, to close to 6% in February and in March. And the Bank of England says it expects it to peak at around 7.25% in April. Surveys show more than half of Britons have perceived a major increase in energy costs in the last few months.
Turning to inflation, UK consumer price inflation rose to 5.4% in December, well above its 2% target, and almost one percentage point higher than expected at the time of the November monetary policy report. Most of the overshoot in inflation relative to the target continues to reflect the more general rise in the price of globally traded goods. Higher energy prices explain nearly one percentage point of the rise in inflation since September. But rising domestic cost pressures, driven by a tight labour market, have also added to the upward pressure on consumer prices, albeit to a lesser extent.
And 85% of Britons say that they have noticed an increase in the cost of groceries. Energy prices are also rising sharply in Britain. Britain's energy regulator has said that the energy price cap that limits the amount of energy suppliers charge their customers will increase by half for about 22 million customers from this April. That will come in at 53% increase. The British government announced that millions of households will also receive energy bill discounts totaling £350 to combat the impacts of the rise in energy prices. But analysts say that is not nearly enough. The move has been criticized for falling short of what was needed to root out the problem, especially for the poorest. Critics also say the government's response to the crisis has been too slow, despite high energy prices for months. The UK is already reeling from the economic aftermath of Brexit, with supply chain disruptions and shortages of skilled labourers.
It is very alarming how the rise in energy prices in Europe is going to affect the poor, or the ones who are in poverty. First of all, let us differentiate between who is poor and who lives in poverty. A poor person is the one who earns an income that does not fully cover all their necessities. A person in poverty is someone who is merely trying to survive. The energy crisis is sure to worsen poverty for millions of Europeans. According to Eurostat figures, around 31 million Europeans are living in energy poverty. One environmental NGO, Friends of the Earth, has said it's a tragedy that in one of the richest continents in the world, one in four European households this winter or more are having to make the decision between heating their homes and having food on the table. The 31 million figure, however, may be underestimated because there is no common definition of energy poverty across Europe. This makes it difficult to know the extent of the problem. For instance, the European Commission, in the 2021 State of the Energy Union report, calculated in 2019 that 50 million people were living in energy poverty, almost 20 million more than the EU's latest estimates. It further added that this number could rise to 80 million because of the current energy price crunch combined with the impact of the COVID-19 crisis. Now, this problem is not just for the ones classified as poor. It's now expanding to other classes of society in Europe. This is something the European Commission has also acknowledged. While the recent price hikes affect everyone, the energy poor and the low and lower middle income households are most impacted because they spend significantly higher shares of their incomes on energy. Governments have offered solutions, short-term ones, but the question remains whether these will be enough, especially since it's not known how long this energy crisis will last. Some of these solutions include temporary tax reductions and lump sum payments to help pay the energy bills. Spain, France, Italy, and Greece have all brought in measures like these to help vulnerable households. But the most alarming figure before the start of the pandemic was the actual level of poverty, not fuel, or the energy poverty that existed in Europe. Already before the pandemic, one in five people in the EU were at risk of poverty and social exclusion, or around 110 million people. In 2020, an estimated 21.9% of the EU population, or some 96.5 million people, were at risk of poverty or social exclusion. Okay, that does it for this segment of the program. I'm Mahdi, and until next time, it's goodbye.
In conclusion, the energy price in Europe is here to stay for the time being. Tensions between Ukraine, over Ukraine, between Russia and the U.S. are persisting. But there's something bigger at play here, and that is the fact that you have the central banks that have printed so much money in order to help the economies, and that is going to hurt these economies. Putting that on top of the energy price hikes, the households across Europe are going to be suffering. And it remains to be seen whether their income is going to rise relative to inflation. Only time will tell. But that does it for this edition of Economic Divide. It was great having you with us. From Mikhail Tafai and the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountain. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Well, then I washed all today's lunch dishes. There was not a lot of dirty dishes left today because I had a light meal. However, I'm going to have a great dinner tonight. Curious to know what I'm going to have for dinner? Actually, I'm going to take you to Tehran's streets. So, you can get familiar with different street foods which are served in the cold seasons in Iran. Labu and baghali are two types of hot foods which are served as snacks in cold winters in different cities of Iran. I love both of them. Street foods are cheap and ready-to-eat foods which are sold by vendors on streets or in bazaars and exhibitions. In Iran, street foods are usually sold on a cart. Most street foods constitute local foods which are of different types based on the geographical location. Street foods are not costly and most people can afford them. People's love for street foods have several reasons, including its low cost and their familiarity with local foods of different ethnicities. Two types of foods which are sold in many cities of Iran are labu and baghali. Labu is cooked beetroot. Iranians cook it either by boiling water or steam. Baghali, literally broad bean, is also cooked in boiling water and served with heraklium and vinegar. I am now at one of the streets of Tehran. In these cold winter nights, you can see carts selling labu and baghali in most of the streets of Tehran.
There is a music, we call it Baghali Daram, Baghali Daram,
Baghali Daram. I said so. This is the voice of a vendor who, by chanting, is trying to attract the attention of people to these delicious foods. Labu and baghali are sold all together.
Thank you. These are labu and baghali. In the cold of winter, people like to eat these snacks. I buy beetroot and broad bean from the vegetable market, then I cook it at home and bring them here and warm it again. I come here in the evenings from 5 or 6 p.m. to midnight. The cost depends on the size of the container. In the past, the cost was calculated based on a measurement scale known as SEER. 2,000 tumans, 3,000 tumans, 5,000 tumans, 10,000 tumans.
Labu is a sweet, delicious snack. Tonight I'm going to eat labu and baghali, both. Wish you were here so you could eat these delicious snacks on such a cold night. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Australian government announces a plan to blacklist the whole of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The country had previously designated Hamas's military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, back in 2003. Under the new restrictions, which will go into force in April, financing or providing any support to Hamas will be criminalized, with some offenses carrying a 25-year prison sentence. The reason for the blacklisting is what Canberra calls the group's, quote, hateful ideologies. But let's dive deeper and learn more about the Gaza-based group. Ever since Hamas scored a landslide victory in Gaza's parliamentary elections in 2006, it has been running the besieged enclave. Protecting the Strip has been one of the group's core responsibilities. Over the years, it has carried out the responsibility, the most recent instance of which came in May 2021, during the Israeli military's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip. The war killed some 250 Palestinians, including 66 children, but only 12 Israelis. If it weren't for the deterrent capabilities of the group, the number of Palestinian casualties would have been a lot higher. How would this justify branding the group as a terrorist organization? The case in point is that any group whose ideology goes against that of the U.S. and its allies is hit with such allegations. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem condemns Australia's decision to list the movement as a terrorist organization and calls on the Australian government to present an apology to the Palestinian people. He said the planned move attests to the biased support for the occupying regime and emboldens Israel to press ahead with its aggression against Palestinian people. The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Resistance Committees were also among Palestinian groups denouncing the decision. Voices of condemnation also came from inside Australia. The Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network, a national coalition of Australians who support Palestinian rights, disagreed with the designation, saying that it does nothing to advance the cause of peace and will only create more suffering for the 2 million people currently living under the 15-year Israeli blockade.
The word terrorist has been essentially coined and put into circulation by Zionists to demonize the people who are resisting their genocide in Palestine and the people all over the world who support that resistance. And in fact, the actual meaning of the word terrorism is deliberately targeting civilians to create fear or terror. And that is a military tactic that has been used since time immemorial by all sorts of different forces.
All in all, in the absence of any meaningful support for the people of Palestine and the condemnation of Tel Aviv, Israel continues to commit gross violations and gets away with murder.
The MKO terrorist group appears to be expanding its operations to include trafficking, among other criminal activities. An Albanian historian and journalist says the country's police have alerted the U.S. embassy that members of the terrorist organization are involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. Alsi Jazeshi, citing Albanian media reports, says the MKO operatives, headed by the terrorist ringleader Mariam Rajavi and based in a camp near the capital Tirana, have attempted to traffic over 400 of the group's own members to France. Jazeshi added that a number of the terrorist cult's members have been detained for trafficking people from the Middle East to Europe, who were most likely Daesh terrorists. The journalist also says some senior MKO members, including the ringleader's sister-in-law, have been arrested while trying to traffic drugs into Italy, with police having prosecuted another member over theft charges. The Albanian police deny sending any letter to the American embassy without elaborating further. The journalist says the terror group has forced an Albanian media outlet to take down an article it published about the arrests.
They used Albania as a safe haven to carry out illegal activities and criminal acts. And now they are becoming a problem for Greece, Italy, Germany, and France. And when I say problem, not just trafficking human beings, drugs, money laundering, and some other activities. They have become a problem for Albania for the crimes I just mentioned, but also burglary, pickpocketing, harassing women, sexual harassment, and at least one case of rape.
Critics in Albania blame the United States and its Western allies for providing protection for the terrorist cult. Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, also known as the MEK, is a notorious anti-Iran terror group that embraces an ideology that mixes Marxism and terrorism. MKO's crimes against Iran run the gamut from collaborating with Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 war on Iran to a violent campaign of bombings across the country. One of the group's highest profile acts of terror came on June 28, 1981, when a powerful bomb went off at the headquarters of an Iranian political party, the Islamic Republican Party, where the party's leaders were holding a meeting. The bombing killed scores of Iranian officials, including the then head of Supreme Judicial Council, Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti. Most recently, Iran said there were traces of MKO involvement in the assassination of Iran's top scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, in November 2020. The anti-Iran organization has long been recognized as a terror group by much of the international community. However, in June 2008, the United Kingdom crossed the group off its terror list. The move was followed by the European Union in 2009 and the United States in 2012. Canada followed in the footsteps of the Western countries in delisting MKO as a terror group in December 2012 without offering any reason for the decision.
Some of them have their hands stained with blood. Some of them have battlefield experience. Some of them have some formal training by Mukhabarat, the special secret police of Saddam Hussein. So they are not just poor people trying to go to Europe to make a living. They are a danger. Criminals need to go to prison, not to roam in the streets of European cities. Absolutely. This is my idea.
Since removing their decade-long ban on the MKO, the Western nations, especially the United States, have used the group as a tool to pressure Iran. But the latest revelations about the terror organization can serve as a wake-up call for its Western supporters that the threats they have been brewing against Iran will backfire on them.
The government of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is in trouble. His cabinet has invoked a rarely used emergency ordinance to quell anti-vaccine truck protests that have crippled the country. The Emergency Act can authorize the use of the military. It can also temporarily suspend citizens' rights to free movement or assembly, and the government is taking steps to stop financial support of illegal protests. The measure allows Canadian banks to freeze accounts suspected of funding the blockades and suspend insurance on vehicles in the protests. Trudeau has noted that the measures will be time-limited, geographically targeted, as well as reasonable and proportionate. The Canadian law, which was passed in 1988, says, "For the purpose of this act, a national emergency is an urgent and critical situation of a temporary nature that cannot be effectively dealt with under any other law of Canada." Trudeau said, "The government is not overriding the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, nor limiting the right to peaceful assembly."
The federal government has invoked the Emergencies Act to supplement provincial and territorial capacity to address the blockades and occupations.
The plan has drawn widespread condemnation from Canadians, including the Premier in Quebec, Francis Legault, who said Trudeau's announcement risked putting oil on the fire. The trouble all began after thousands of protesters in trucks and other vehicles blocked the streets of Ottawa, as well as two border crossings with the U.S. to vent their frustration over COVID-19 vaccine mandates. The protests have not stayed in Canada, though. Similar freedom convoy protests have grown in countries like the U.S., France, New Zealand, Australia. As common with protests, many have also vented their anger against the government due to their economic situation as a result of COVID-19.
Spontaneous thing where people are upset. That's one whole part of this, and it's part of a general movement, I think, that we're seeing around the world of the ultra-right asserting itself and using the money of the millionaires to do it.
The so-called Freedom Convoy protest started with truckers protesting COVID-19 vaccine or quarantine mandate. It then broadened to include people opposing all coronavirus-related restrictions announced by the Trudeau government. The protest has attracted the support of thousands of Canadians, even some who are fully vaccinated. They say all COVID-19 preventive measures must be dropped. The protests have drawn support from groups from the U.S.
Having is a right-wing attack on all kinds of things, because one of the demands of the people in Canada was that Trudeau should resign, and the other was that the western part of the country should secede. So, you know, these are not just little political things. So you have, in Canada in particular, the implementation of a very conservative right-wing agenda. And everybody agrees on that, especially the right-wing who's doing it. So this isn't just some kind of, you know, spontaneous thing where people are upset.
Canadian authorities have said about half of the funding for the protests has come from U.S. supporters. Toronto Dominion Bank last week froze two personal bank accounts that received $1.4 million Canadian dollars for the protests. In the western Canadian province of Alberta, police have broke up a group that was armed and prepared to use violence. The protests that have hindered traffic at border crossings have impacted more than $500 million in commerce each day.
I think that what happened was that the automobile companies complained. You know, there's production shut down, millions of dollars lost, and it was pretty clear that that was very unpopular. And he waited long enough for the economy to be heard and people to be heard and said, enough's enough. And I think the balance of force has changed a bit because of that.
Truckers and their supporters have gathered in the capital, Ottawa, since January 29th to rally against mask mandates, lockdowns, restrictions on gatherings, and other COVID-19 preventive measures. Some downtown Ottawa businesses have had to shut down temporarily. There have been reports of rock throwing, property damage, harassment, and even hate crimes.
The Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood made headlines once again on Sunday. Clashes broke out between Israeli forces and Palestinian residents in the area after far-right Jewish lawmaker Itamar Ben-Gvir opened a parliamentary office in Sheikh Jarrah. Tens of Palestinians were injured in the Israeli crackdown. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates condemned Ben-Gvir's step as a provocative and escalating move that threatens to ignite violence. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry says the Israeli regime is fully and directly responsible for the escalation in the occupied Al-Quds and potentially dire consequences of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It added that the failure of the international community and the United Nations Security Council to take necessary measures to compel Israel to stop its occupation of Al-Quds encourages the occupying power to forge ahead with its colonial Judaization projects in the Holy City.
Well, that was expected, and he did it largely as a publicity stunt and to raise his profile within Zionist politics in Israel, and of course to shove it in the face of the Palestinian Christian and Arab or Muslim community that lives in the area. But it was designed for controversy, but it definitely is a political stunt, and it's designed to increase tensions in the area. And this is most unfortunate and illegal, and mostly condemned around the world as an attempt to Judaize the area and to drive out the Palestinians.
Earlier, the Hamas resistance movement had issued a strongly worded message of warning to the Israeli regime and settlers after the latter renewed their attacks on Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Mohammed Hamadeh, a spokesman for the Gaza-based movement, said the attack amounts to a clear violation and that Israel was playing with fire. Israel's attempts to evict families from the Flashpoint Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood resulted in an 11-day war between Gaza-based Palestinian resistance groups and Israel back in May. Israel is evicting Palestinians to make way for its settlement-building activities. This is while under international law, all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal. The United Nations Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Al-Quds remains at the heart of the decades-long conflict, with Palestinians insisting that East Al-Quds, illegally occupied by Israel since 1967, must serve as the capital of a Palestinian state. In the meantime, the Al-Aqsa Mosque has had enormous significance throughout the years. In the year 2000, an Israeli official's visit to the holy site provoked a Palestinian uprising known as the Second Intifada. Observers believe any escalation of violence or provocative action by Israeli forces in the Holy City could serve as a prelude to a new intifada.
It is part of the Judaization of East Jerusalem, and it's an attempt by Zionists to drive the Christian and Muslim Arabs out of the city and increase the Jewish population.
Emboldened by former U.S. President Donald Trump's unqualified support, Tel Aviv expanded its illegal activities against the people of Palestine. Many were expecting a turn of events when Trump left office. But the regime continues to carry out its acts of aggression in the absence of any meaningful action from the international community.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
As we clerics say, there is a room for degrees when it comes to who is revolutionary. It is possible that a person has better conduct when it comes to revolutionary concepts and activities, and that another person does not. But the latter is taking the same path. If we accuse any person who does not have the great and complete performance of being a non-revolutionary and anti-revolutionary, this is a mistake. It is possible that the value of a person's movement is 100% and the value of another individual's movement is less. But both are taking the same path. The important thing is that the movement should be in line with the revolutionary criteria. The important thing is criteria. The important thing is that even a person who does not move forward in a completely resolute manner should have revolutionary criteria. If these criteria exist, then that party is a revolutionary one, no matter if it is an individual, a group of individuals, or a government or organization. The main point is that we should know these criteria.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There are specific criteria for being a revolutionary. I'd like to mention five criteria during this meeting. Of course, more criteria can be mentioned, but for the moment, I will mention five criteria for being a revolutionary. We should try to have and preserve these criteria wherever we are. A person might work in art, another might work in an industry, another might work in politics, another might be involved in scientific activities, and yet another might be involved in economic and commercial activities. It does not make any difference. These criteria can exist in all Iranians. These are the five criteria which I will expand on later. a commitment to the main principles and values of the revolution, aiming at the ideals of the revolution and making great efforts to attain them, the commitment to the independence of the country in all areas, showing sensitivity in the face of the enemy and the enemy's plots. The fifth criterion is religious and political piety, which is very important.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
In the limelight.
In the United States, where inflation is at its highest in four decades, the latest chatter on Wall Street is that the U.S. Federal Reserve will take every opportunity to raise interest rates. This will happen between now and the end of the year. We have prepared for you an article written by Larry Elliott under the heading, Central banks should be cautious in calibrating a response to inflation. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Central banks are getting twitchy about inflation. Cost of living pressures are rising just about everywhere, and the relaxed mood of last autumn has been replaced by an urgency that could soon become panic. In the United States, where inflation is at its highest rate in four decades, the latest chatter on Wall Street is that the U.S. Federal Reserve will take every opportunity to raise interest rates between now and the end of the year, seven times in all. Inflation figures for the United Kingdom were out on Wednesday, 16th of February, and even though little change is expected this month from the 5.4% recorded in December, further increases are expected by the spring. The Bank of England forecast should be taken with a pinch of salt because they have been wrong for the past year. But for what it's worth, Threadneedle Street now predicts inflation to peak at just over 7%. The Bank of England and the US Federal Reserve are getting stick for waiting so long before taking steps to rein in inflation. It is said the United States and the United Kingdom economies are overheating as the threat from the pandemic recedes, one reason being that central banks have delayed putting up borrowing costs. This might seem a compelling argument, but the idea that the United States, the United Kingdom, and the big economies of the Eurozone are in the middle of a rampant boom doesn't square with the facts. Officials claim the fastest growing G7 economy over the past 2 years has been the United States, where output has increased by 1.5% on average. The next best performing country has been France, where economic growth has averaged less than 0.5% a year. Britain's output is 0.4% below its pre-pandemic level, while Germany and Italy have still more ground to make up. So where is the inflation coming from? The answer is that prices are rising more quickly than they were because of supply-side pressures. As economies lifted restrictions and demand has returned to more normal levels, although not boom levels, severe bottlenecks have emerged. Everything from computer chips to natural gas has been in short supply, and that has pushed up inflation. This was the explanation the US Federal Reserve and the Bank of England trotted out last summer and autumn when price pressures first started to bite, and it was broadly right. Yes, they said interest rates would need to be raised from their emergency levels, but there was no great urgency because their economies were still operating short of where they would have been in the absence of COVID-19. In any event, increasing the cost of borrowing would have zero impact on global energy prices. The Bank of England had an additional problem, which was that Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, removed some of the support the Treasury was providing for the economy last autumn. With the benefit of hindsight, the end of the furlough did not lead to the feared rise in unemployment, but there was no way of knowing that at the time. As a result, the Bank's Monetary Policy Committee responded to the Chancellor's tightening of policy by keeping interest rates lower than they might otherwise have been. As the National Institute for Economic and Social Research pointed out recently, it would have been preferable had policy been the other way round, with a less aggressive approach by Rishi Sunak providing space for the bank to raise interest rates modestly. The Bank of England and the US Federal Reserve subsequently realised price pressures were more acute than they had predicted, while unemployment fell more quickly. This raised concerns that workers would use the bargaining power provided by a tight labour market to secure higher pay awards. If, say, an annual inflation rate of 7.5% in the United States led to salary increases of 8%, a wage price spiral redolent of the 1970s would then set in. In the short term, inflationary pressures are likely to persist. The first 3 months of 2022 will be an echo of the last summer, as restrictions are lifted and economies open up. Those people who have built up savings during lockdown now have cash to spare to buy a new car or book a foreign holiday. Firms will have trouble filling vacancies, while energy costs will remain high as long as there is a tension between Russia and the West over Ukraine. The cost of a barrel of oil is already closing in on $100. Things look a lot trickier from spring onwards. In Britain, energy bills and taxes both go up in April, and it will become clear to many workers that their wages are not keeping up with inflation. Cost increases that were initially inflationary will turn deflationary as they add to costs for business and squeeze consumer spending power. Recently, thousands of university workers in Britain have gone on strike in a dispute over employers' policies and pensions, pay and working conditions. The University and College Union, UCU, said in a statement, on day one of the strike planned for coming weeks, large number of university workers on Monday 14th of February formed picket lines in Glasgow and London, chanting slogans, playing music and holding DIY banners. The University and College Union said the staff of 44 universities, including the Universities of Cambridge, Leeds and Edinburgh, are joining the strike this week to protest brutal pension cuts. In coming days, 50,000 staff from around 70 universities are expected to walk out over the employer's proposal, which would see the average staff member losing 35% of their retirement income. The University and College Union General Secretary, Joe Grady, who joined the picket line at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, acknowledged the great support from students. Joe Grady remarked, "The response from students has been overwhelming, and I want to thank every single one of them for standing with us." Grady said the University and College Union has put forward several compromise proposals, but the university employers have failed to accept any of them, referring to thousands of University and College Union members who have joined the strike. She said vice-chancellors should not doubt the resolve of our members, who are determined to stick this out and win what they deserve. Regarding the pay dispute, the University and College Union is demanding a £2,500 pay increase, as well as action to tackle unmanageable workloads, pay inequality, and the use of insecure and exploitative contracts. The development comes on the heels of a recommendation by the Universities and Colleges Employers Association, UCEA, which said the university should dock 100% of pay for staff who work to rule as part of the forthcoming industrial action. Joe Grady complained, "It is outrageous that when they should be trying to resolve this dispute, employer representatives have instead been finding new ways to deduct pay from university workers." She added, "Rather than punishing the workforce, these so-called leaders need to look in the mirror and ask why students support staff taking strike action and why their own workforce is so demoralized." The strike, which is the latest in a long-running dispute, has caused disruption to normal activities of the country's largest universities. In late 2019, the university and college union staff at 60 universities initially went on strike, which grew to 74 institutions in a second wave of strikes in February of 2020. Against this backdrop, the Bank of England needs to calibrate its response carefully, as does the US Federal Reserve. Central banks clearly feel their credibility will be at risk if they allow inflation to take hold, and that means more aggressive approach to interest rates that seemed likely as recently as late last year. There is a way that central banks can emerge with their credibility intact if they are right in believing inflation is currently a supply-side problem. Only a limited tightening of policy will be needed. Inflation will come down with only a small increase in unemployment. The Bank of England and the US Federal Reserve will then be the heroes of the hour. Of course, there is an alternative scenario in which central banks act tough but still damage their credibility, which is what will happen if they add to the pain already coming the way of their economies through interest rate overkill. The growing risk of that would quickly turn the recovery of early 2022 into a recession of early 2023.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Cleaning up the mess left behind by Storm Eunice that battered the UK this week. With record speeds of nearly 200 kilometers per hour, much of the country from Scotland to England felt the force of the storm's temper. Footage posted to social media showed trees fall, history be realigned, railway travel disrupted, planes struggling to land, iconic landmarks damaged. The capital, London, issued its first ever rat severe weather warning. Here too, authorities asked residents not to leave home.
So the message to Londoners is, whilst the Met Office has the red weather warning, stay indoors. A storm Eunice is the worst storm we've faced in three decades. It's really important we don't inadvertently put ourselves in harm's way by being outdoors.
Many heeded the warning and stayed home. Others did not. Three people were killed.
One of those killed, a woman in her 30s, traveling in a car with a man of the same age here in North London when this tree fell onto their vehicle, killing her but sparing her partner.
Eunice knocked out electricity for tens of thousands of households on its path. The government had already been warned that the UK lacks the resilience to deal with storms, particularly in terms of electricity infrastructure. Here in London, there is a sense of worry about what's to come next.
I guess you're just not really used to it happening, and I guess it's just one of those things that's going to happen more often, and we need to do more to be prepared to deal with them.
I'd say it's quite concerning because it kind of makes me think of the bigger picture of where the entire climate is headed, where we're headed as a species.
Everything was just in disarray. It was crazy and chaotic, and I know a lot of people felt scared.
Eunice was predicted to be the first storm in 30 years and certainly won't be the last. The clear-up phase is well underway now, but the wider debate about the state of the UK's resilience against storms is only just gathering pace. Saeed Pourreza, London.
On Friday, school pupils held protests in over 40 cities across Italy demanding the government to put an end to obligatory work placements in the last 3 years of school. The demonstrations were staged after a student, 16-year-old Giuseppe Lenoci, died in a road accident on Monday while he was on board a truck for a school work internship. Last month, another student, 18-year-old Lorenzo Perrelli, was crushed to death by a steel girder of 150 kilos while working in an internship for a private company.
È una vergogna.
They should be ashamed. School principals should be reported to the authorities for striking deals with private companies without being provided assurances on working conditions in factories. They have been reckless and should be punished.
Lavoro non pagato, praticamente sfruttamento.
Schoolwork internship is equivalent to unpaid work. It is just another form of exploitation. In most cases, it doesn't give anything to students. It only helps companies make more profit.
About 3,000 students gathered in central Rome demanding the government to remove the education minister and scrap obligatory work experience programs for high school students introduced by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi in 2015. In Turin, tension and anger went out of control when a group of students tried to break into the local headquarters of industrial employers group Confindustria and were repelled by police with some batons being wielded, with at least 7 officers being hurt.
We are staging protests also to raise awareness over our living conditions as young adults. Our generation is suffering greatly also from the anti-COVID measures, which restricts our freedom to move, to interact socially. We are left alone with our phones following school lessons online, with our psychological scars, and the government is not doing anything to help us.
School dropout levels in Italy are among the highest in the EU, and due to the pandemic, with the government quickly deciding to make all learning remote. Also, the cases of social withdrawal and self-harm among young people are on the rise. Healthcare professionals are warning. In the past 2 years, and especially in recent months, Italy has been the scene of protests across the country. Rallies have been held against deteriorating living conditions, mandatory vaccination and health passes, as well as what the protesters describe as the government's mismanagement of the COVID pandemic. Max Civili, Rome.
Dozens of Nigerian Muslims, mostly supporters of prominent cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, demonstrated in Abuja to condemn Saudi Arabia for the war on Yemen and its continued blockade of the impoverished country. They said the bombing of civilian targets by the Saudi-led coalition and its siege on Yemen has caused a serious humanitarian situation there.
A coalition of Saudi Kingdom and that of United Arab Emirates, we are launching a strike on the innocent people of Yemen. They have been killing a lot of women, children, men, and everywhere, at their houses, at their business places, hospitals, schools, everywhere. Nowhere is safe in Yemen. They are killing, and the world is silent.
The Saudi war has escalated recently as Riyadh has intensified its aerial and ground attacks, worsening the humanitarian situation in Yemen. The protesters said the